I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Americans are demanding new choices about where and how they live. For the past 50 years, drivable suburbanism has been the norm, coupled with decaying central cities. But that familiar pattern is reversing, in part, thanks to our two guests today. John Talmadge runs Social Compact, an organization that is uncovering the numbers that show inner-city neighborhoods have far more people and far more buying power than official counts suggest, and he's helping cities capitalize on that with revitalization. Chris Lineberger is a metropolitan land strategist and developer. In his new book, Chris makes a compelling case for why the next American dream will be walkable urban neighborhoods. We'll talk to these urban developers today on Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Chris Lineberger is a metropolitan land strategist and developer. His firm, Arcadia Land Development, was formed to create walkable communities in harmony with nature. He's also a professor at the University of Michigan Graduate Real Estate Program. He's just written a new book, The Option of Urbanism, Investing in the Next American Dream, out this month from Island Press. Chris, your book is subtitled Investing in the Next American Dream. Describe the next American dream.
It might help to take a look at the last two American dreams. The first was driven by the agricultural economy back in the 18th and 19th century, and it could be characterized as to how it sits on the land as 40 acres and a mule. That was the great Jeffersonian yeoman farmer image. And then in the late 19th into the 20th century, we were a car-driven economy. It was an industrial economy that was based upon building cars. About a third of all jobs somehow related to building, maintaining, selling, building roads, producing oil for cars. And so how the American dream played out on the ground was an extension of that. It was driven by that, and it obviously was suburbia. But now what we're seeing is a much more complex world, and that the market is demanding choice. And they want the choice of one of the two only ways that we can build the American dream. One is drivable suburban, which we've had as our domestic policy for the last 50, 60, 70 years. And the other is walkable urbanism, the other option by which we can build the built environment. And the market has a hunger for walkable urbanism today. There's pent-up demand. It's not for everybody, but there is pent-up demand for walkable urban development.
Why is there pent-up demand? What are the market forces at work pushing us toward walkable urbanism?
Well, it's basically being driven by the Gen Xers, and I'm sure the Gen Xers are happy to hear this. It's finally not the baby boomers doing something. And that the Gen Xers were brought up on Friends and Seinfeld and an image of urbanism that was different than their parents and their grandparents. And they saw urbanism, walkable urbanism, as a very exciting, safe way to live their lives. And given the fact that the vast majority of growth over the next 20, 30 years is going to be in single household and childless couple households, you know, the vast majority will be in those categories. Those categories have a predilection for walkable urbanism.
It simply suits their lifestyles better?
It suits their lifestyles, and quite honestly, anytime you have too much of a good thing, you get bored with it. So back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, we offered the market, say that you were going to move to Columbus, Ohio, and you wanted to live in a nice upper-middle-income kind of house, and you would have a choice of a single-family house or a single-family house. Take your choice. And if you wanted to go shopping for groceries, you could drive to a 1980s strip mall or a 1990s strip mall. Take your choice. There was no option. And it was because we've put in place, because we wanted to, there's no conspiracy here, that we put in place a domestic policy that's still in place today that massively subsidizes drivable suburban. We in real estate only know how to do it. It's what's legally on the books. It's only legal to build drivable suburban in most parts of the country. And Wall Street only knows how to finance that stuff, which, of course, is the ultimate irony because people on Wall Street live in walkable urbanism, but they have a hard time financing it.
Well, you say that people wanted it on the one hand. It was a response to what people wanted. And yet you're also pointing out it was a response to policy. Did policy follow what the market wanted, or did policy precede what the market wanted?
It's obviously the ultimate chicken-egg question, and I'm not certain there is an answer to it, but my gut tells me that the market wanted this, and then the policy was put in place to give the market what it wanted. So I point out in the book that the 1939 World's Fair in New York was the most popular World's Fair in history, and the most popular exhibit at the World's Fair was an exhibit called Futurama. And Futurama showed this brave new world of 1960, and it showed a suburban paradise. And about 10 to 15% of the American people went through Futurama, and it was heavily covered in the news media, Life magazine, and all these other places were just focused on this grand new vision. And that vision sort of was set in 39. It percolated during the war, and it exploded after the war, and we got what we wanted. It's a good news, bad news story. The good news is we got Futurama. The bad news is we got Futurama. And we put these policies in place to reinforce it, almost unthinkingly about the unintended consequences. But I think we would have done it no matter what. Even if we knew the unintended consequences, I think we were so excited about this kind of development. And we put it in place with a vengeance.
And what were the unintended consequences that you refer to of drivable suburbanism?
Well, first, let's look at the intended consequences, because there are some positive things. One of the things that we wanted was privacy. And, privacy is a new concept in this world. Having a private environment and being able to have the freedom of movement of a car is really quite remarkable and quite exceptional in the history of the world. And we got that. And we still jealously guard those benefits. We also got very cheap housing because we subsidized it tremendously. And therefore, we became among the leading nations as far as households owning their own house, which I think is a tremendous social benefit. So there were a lot of good things that took place. On the unintended consequence side, things that we didn't think through is obviously things such as obesity and asthma that are at epidemic proportions. 40-50% of that is a result scientifically. It's now been demonstrated as a result of drivable suburban development. We have obviously a very reliant economy upon oil. And that oil, of course, is coming from some pretty nasty people who are not particularly friendly with us. And the concept of peak oil is finally getting through to the public consciousness that at some point, and maybe even it's past that point, we are going to be producing less and less oil in an absolute sense, but we know what's happening to the demand side. So, $84 a barrel oil is going to look cheap over the next few years. And that, by the way, has influenced our foreign policy. Just as Alan Greenspan said in his recent book, that the Iraq war is obviously about oil. One of the most important things, of course, is climate change. And it doesn't take a genius to understand, even though there are still the apologists on the right that don't get it, that drivable suburban is probably 60, 70, 75% of the reason behind climate change and CO2 emissions. That it's either in the built environment or it's the transportation system, and we're going to have to deal with climate change, and the built environment's going to have to do a major policy change to really attack this issue. But the beauty of it is that, again, the market wants this. So it's not as if we have to force the market to do something that they don't want to do to reduce CO2 emissions. And there's lots of other unintended consequences, too. In the book, I lay out about 20, 25 of them, and it's pretty overwhelming just what we've traded off for the supposed freedom of the car and a low-density, drivable, suburban-built environment.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the forces that you just mentioned, an economy reliant on oil, a foreign policy then that follows, which is enormously costly, climate change, obesity, are those forces pushing us toward walkable urbanism, more dense urban places? Are those forces as powerful, in your opinion, as were the Interstate Highway Act and cheap federal-backed mortgage lending that enabled the last American dream?
I'm a great believer that the market will get what the market wants, and it may take a little bit longer. We obviously have a market failure here because we have put in place these four policy levers that I spoke of earlier that really dictates this one option for people, only drivable suburban. But in spite of that, you know, the power of the government, the power of Wall Street, the legal power that you must build drivable suburban product only, that the market is still getting a great deal of walkable urbanism. We see so many we see so many examples throughout the country of walkable urban development taking place in spite of that. And the really interesting fact about what's going on the ground is that the market is assessing, my research shows, between a 40 and 200% premium on a price per square foot basis for walkable urban product over drivable suburban. That people are willing to pay 40% more to three times more for walkable urban product in cities and metro areas throughout the country. And it's not just downtown, by the way. Downtown's, you know, a big part of this turnaround story is the downtown turnaround story. But it's suburban town centers that are, you know, such as Evanston in Chicago, or Birmingham in Detroit, or Bethesda in Washington. These places are becoming some of the most vital walkable urban places in the country. And then finally, we see lifestyle centers, which are these, you know, these faux downtowns that are being created on greenfield sites throughout the country that, before 2006, 80% of those faux main streets, you know, open air, Banana Republic, Gap kind of main streets, were retail only. Currently, what's under construction or planned for lifestyle centers, two-thirds of them are mixed use, generally with housing on top. So we're beginning to learn how to build these things from scratch as well.
Although, Chris, it strikes me that not many people are going to be walking to what you call faux main streets or these lifestyle centers. I mean, certainly, as you say, those that live there will, but won't most everyone else drive? I mean, does that really create, and most of them are on a big highway, so I mean, does that really create walkable urbanism?
Well, Rome was not built in a day. And
oh, you optimist, you.
I know. But I can give you an example that I think will prove my point. And the granddaddy of lifestyle centers and the most impressive example of a lifestyle center in the country is Reston Town Center outside of Washington, D.C. It's 30 miles from the Capitol, and it was built on a greenfield site right next to the proverbial, you know, 12-lane freeway. And it is only accessible by car, by people who live there, walking there, and they have a bus center there now. Well, and this is about 10 million square feet of space, where 20 years ago it was a greenfield site. It's very urbane, very walkable. Thousands of units are there, getting a tremendous price premium over the rest of the marketplace there in Reston. And in 2012, they're going to get a metro stop. And the reason they're going to get a metro stop is because they are transit ready. So you build these lifestyle centers, and if you are smart in how you locate them, that eventually light rail, heavy rail, commuter rail will catch up, and you'll be able to service it with rail-based transit.
What kinds of densities are needed to support transit?
Generally speaking, walkable urbanism starts at about a floor area ratio of about 0.8.
Explain that.
Floor area ratio is one of the many ways of measuring density. So if you have a 100,000 square foot piece of dirt, about 2.5 acres, and you put 80,000 square feet of product on that 100,000 square feet of dirt, you've got a floor area ratio of 0.8.
Gotcha.
A typical drivable suburban commercial place is between 0.2 and 0.3. So a strip mall, a regional mall, will be of that 100,000 square foot piece of dirt, they'll end up putting 20,000 square feet of building on it. The other 80,000 square feet of that piece of dirt will be surface parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be at least 4 or 5 times as dense is when walkable urbanism begins, and it can go up to, you know, it can go up to floor area ratios of 2, 3, 5, 10. New York City's, in at least Midtown Manhattan, is probably between 30 and 35 floor area ratio. So there is a vast range of walkable urban product possible. It can go from, you know, small towns that are, 0.8, 1.0 FAR, up to Manhattan and everything in between. And that's the beauty of walkable urbanism, is that it offers so many options. People can have a small town walkable life. They can have a suburban town center walkable life. They can have a lifestyle center out in the country walkable life, or they can have a high-density Manhattan-like experience. What we do know is there's just not enough of this stuff, that the market is in front of our ability to produce this stuff, and that the research shows that most American cities that we've done consumer research in, somewhere between 30-40% of the households want walkable urbanism, and another 30% are ambivalent that they will take walkable urbanism or drivable suburbanism. They're sort of agnostic. And then 30-40% of us want drivable suburbanism. So with 30-40% minimum that want walkable urban development, most American metropolitan areas have no more than 5-10% supply. So you've got this pent-up demand and very little supply, and Adam Smith taught us 200 years ago that when you have those situations, you get the kind of price premiums that we're seeing, those 40% to 200% price premiums for walkable urban product.
You've talked about density as being key to walkable urbanism. What else?
Well, to be walkable, it's got to be safe, and it's got to be connected. That you can't have high density and then run a freeway down the middle of it and expect people to go under or over that freeway. So there's been a great deal of work done, scientific work done, on understanding what are the components of walkability. And density is certainly one. Mixed uses is very important, so that you have a reason to walk in these districts, and that there are not barriers to your walking in these districts.
You've talked about the unintended consequences of drivable suburbanism. What do you think might be the unintended consequences of walkable urbanism?
Well, the first and foremost that everybody sees very quickly is the flip side of that 40 to 200% price premium, and it's known as gentrification. And there is an immediate knee-jerk reaction that, oh my God, this is terrible because we're going to have a lot of displacement of people. And in my classes that I teach at the University of Michigan, I'm a really tough professor. I make them watch popular movies. And one of the ones that I make them watch is Back to the Future. And there's Back to the Future 1 and Back to the Future 2 are both great urbanist movies. But Back to the Future 2 the main theme is that the bad guy, Biff, gets a book from 30 years in the future with all the sports scores for the next 30 years. And he bets on sporting events and, by definition, wins all the time because he knows what the scores are going to be. And he builds up this great empire. Well, we know pretty much where the walkable urban places are going to go. It's going to be driven by the transit in particular, but it also will be driven by putting overlay zoning on top of places that want and can receive walkable urban development. So we as policymakers, we as government officials, we as citizens pretty much know where these walkable urban places are going to go. So if you know something like that, and you know that land's going to go from $5 a square foot to $100 per square foot, and we can't figure a way to take advantage of that to pay for affordable housing, shame on us.
And you did that in Albuquerque, didn't you, with your development?
Yes. We set up the Albuquerque Civic Trust, which was set up to profit from gentrification. Now, you know, that was a experiment, and there's still, you know, there's a lot of bugs that need to be worked out of these kind of mechanisms. But, you know, it's not only taking advantage of the gentrification to pay for the affordable housing. There's all sorts of other things that can be done, such as making granny flats legal, putting in place zoning that mandates 10 to 20% affordable housing, a variety of things that we can do. There's efforts at the federal level to put in new workforce housing tax credits, for instance, that will be brought forward over the next year or two, work that Brookings is doing. So there are going to be many answers to this, but the most important answer is that walkable urbanism takes place in a few places, and those places are relatively small in size. They're between 200 and 500 acres in size for the regional serving walkable urban places. And they are driven by transportation, just like urban development has always been driven. Transportation drives development. And since transit systems are such a great motivator for these kinds of places, that's a government decision. So if we're smart, we can get in front of that major unintended consequence of walkable urbanism.
Chris Leinberger's new book is The Option of Urbanism, Investing in the Next American Dream, published later this month by Island Press. Chris, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you so much, Carol.
The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Plan Edison assistant editor Nate Berg.
The Army Corps of Engineers has announced a plan for a massive buyout of more than 17,000 homes in the coastal community of Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, a plan that local residents are not too happy to hear about. They're mainly unhappy because they first heard about this plan only last month, more than 2 years after the community was devastated by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, and long after many residents had already begun rebuilding. The Los Angeles Times reports that the proposed buyout would take out more than half of the Bay community. The Army Corps of Engineers has until the end of the year to submit their plans to Congress for the $10 billion project, which many say legislators will be unlikely to pass. But even if Congress doesn't pass the buyout, negative effects are already being felt as investors pull out of projects and the development that had just started to gain momentum is once again stalled. And while homeowners in Bay St. Louis face the threat of a buyout, McMansion owners across the country may face losing a valuable federal government handout. A bill has been proposed that would scale back the federal tax deductions the government allows on mortgage interest payments for homes larger than 3,000 square feet. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, the bill would reduce the amount of deductions homeowners could take on their oversized homes, using a graduated scale that would limit deductions to 85, 40, and 10% of what they are currently allowed. And homes larger than 4,200 square feet would be allowed no deduction. If approved, this bill would stand to save the country big time, as it is estimated that with no changes, these mortgage deductions could total more than $400 billion between now and 2010. And finally, developers in Dubai have announced yet another mega project for the bustling Arabian Emirate. Gulf News reports that plans have been released for a 75-kilometer canal project to run through Dubai, with waterfront cities and developments all along the canal's banks. The U-shaped canal will begin and end at two different points on the Persian Gulf coast, and will travel into and around the major areas of development in this rapidly changing city. The developers are calling it the Middle East's biggest civil engineering project in history, and construction on the $11 billion canal is expected to start this December and finish in 2010. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk with John Talmadge about the undiscovered buying power in America's inner city neighborhoods and how cities can capitalize on it. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. John Talmadge is president and chief executive of Social Compact. Prior to joining Social Compact, John served as the deputy director for economic development for the city of New Orleans, where he focused on workforce development, international trade, and business recruitment and retention. John also worked in New York City with communities throughout North Brooklyn to address economic development, housing, and land use issues. John, you work directly with a number of mayors across the country. What are they worried about today?
I think that they are worried about several things. They're worried that there's not a cohesive urban agenda today that gives them a place where they see their participation, where they see a place in it for them. They see that with so many changes at the federal level with globalization and whatnot, that there's not a lot of attention being paid to how are these being articulated at a very localized level it's not just their city but in their communities. And what they express to me often is that they're particularly concerned that there's not a toolkit that they have access to for them to put their arms around it, something, and to address their own problems on their own. I mean, you see the mayors take the lead on the Kyoto protocols. You've seen the mayors take the lead on a new job performance opportunities. And they have the capacity, they have the willingness, they have the organization, but they don't have all the tools and resources that they need to be more effective.
What tools and resources do they need?
Well, I think from our perspective, the number one tool they don't have is accurate information about what the existing conditions in their cities are like. We spend a lot of time with Mayor Diaz in Miami. When we were working in Liberty City and Overtown, to find that the populations are actually 95% larger than the census estimates it, and that the incomes are 30% higher than proprietary market analytics estimate. That's a key missing piece of information that they need. So if they're planning for a new bus system or which schools to open or close, if they get that wrong because the information is so wrong, then they're making some pretty, some potentially bad decisions.
And are they getting the information is inaccurate because it's just hard to collect, or we're just not trying hard enough, we don't know how to collect it? What's going wrong?
I think it's all the above. On the surface, the census may be the best tool we have from the Atlantic to the Pacific, but to have such a common methodology is very difficult to apply it in neighborhoods where language may be a problem, housing's an issue, housing may be overcrowded, there may be intergenerational families living in a home. And so people don't want to participate sometimes. But there are also methodological problems that come out as well. So, for example, the census doesn't recognize when they do the new census estimates, they don't recognize rehabilitation, rehabs. It's all a new permit. And that's a bias against the older urban cities that we know, that you, Carol, you and I work in every day. And so that's sort of the first place. And then it emanates from there because according to Brookings, 80% of all private investment in retail, commercial, and residential has a demographic component to it. So if those numbers are wrong, and in the case of Miami, so wrong, then there's an information barrier that the mayors have to hurdle in order to try to bring home some of these projects they need.
Is this one of the reasons that when we finally get the census, the complete census numbers. We were surprised, for instance, in 2000 at the growth that had occurred in cities because of the way in which information is gathered during the interim.
I think that's a fair point. The mayors, I mean, the Mayor Villagrosa in Los Angeles, at the day that the census was released, he supposed that their undercount was 175,000 people.
Wow.
Now, that number doesn't get released until the second year after the centennial census is conducted, so 2012, 2002. So it's already old. It's already 2 years old anyway. And, you know, they're – I mean, we've worked in community development together. Communities don't necessarily have the incentive to go out and participate fully in such a large project because they're not sure how it's connected to their own strategies. And I think that part of the toolkits that we're talking about, it's not just getting the numbers right, but finding better ways to localize information so that people are using that as an empowerment tool to understand their own communities better as well. And that gives them more motivation to participate in these kind of counts.
You mentioned your work in Miami and Liberty City and Overtown. Those are two of the toughest neighborhoods, maybe in the country, to redevelop. And good people have spent many dollars and much time for many years trying to rehabilitate, renew those neighborhoods for their existing residents. And it's been very, very tough going. You work in a number of cities that have these kinds of neighborhoods that are severely challenged. I know you worked in New Orleans and Detroit and Cleveland and many others. What typically, John, leads to a neighborhood being so troubled? Is it simply a matter of this is where poor people live and therefore reinvestment doesn't occur, they don't have the money and government doesn't pay much attention, or is it something more complex than that?
I think it's something more complex, and I think it begins with a social disinvestment, if you will. That neighborhood, I mean, you know, we can all point to neighborhoods where if the schools are functioning and there are jobs or the local jobs that people can work in locally. If there's opportunities for local wealth generation and small business development. You know, so the things that you're so well known for, issues around the creative industry or economy, where that comes together, you know their communities and they function. But when the social disinvestment begins, when we don't make the initial investments into the housing stock, into the school system, into the public health, especially the children's public health, then that has a cascading effect that takes it right down to the bricks and mortar of people's homes. So that when something such as the subprime mess we're dealing with happens, there is no alternative. There's no mitigation at the community to help support a restructuring of community capital.
But fair or not, I think a lot of people look, and you mentioned schools, a lot of people look at schools and say, well, that's the most expensive item in the municipal budget. It's more than everything else put together. It feels like we're spending a lot of money, but we're not getting commensurate results. So do you agree with that statement? And if not, how do you see it? How do you see the investments paying off?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, I go back to information. I'll get to that in a second. But I was having this conversation with a friend in a foundation recently. If you look at all the money we spent in the federal government and the national foundations and the cities and whatnot on poverty alleviation, I mean, it's hundreds, if not, multiples of hundreds of billions of dollars to really not show a lot of result. I mean, certainly we have opportunities to show where poverty rates have declined, but we're not sure what the impact has been. And so, I think you can pick your poison. Affordable housing, we've done a very good job with because we've built out the infrastructure so that the affordable housing problem can be addressed. It doesn't mean that we have enough affordable housing, we've put enough money into it, but you've built out the infrastructure to address the problem. And I don't think that we look at communities in terms of continuums. So we don't look at the continuum of education and how education is connected to health and to outgrowth jobs and whatnot. We've siloed community development so much, and I always point to Mari Gallagher's work, where she worked in Detroit and Chicago, but where she shows correlations of obesity and diabetes rates to grocery store development. Well, that's an innovative way of looking at community development comprehensively. But when you have the, and going back to the numbers, if Detroit's population really is 1.1 million as opposed to 870,000, or if Miami's population is really 600,000 as opposed to 417, if the numbers are so wrong, it's hard to – and when I say the numbers are wrong, there are in some neighborhoods that there's more strength, but in some neighborhoods there's been more disinvestment than people suppose. We're not using scarce resources effectively. We're not leveraging them because we don't understand the intersection of the information to the community itself, so that we can't bring the financial services in. We can't bring the private sector in a more robust way. So should schools have more money spent on it? Absolutely, yes. You know, you invest in a child early on and, you know, it lasts you a good 80, 90 years. But there's so many other parts about that. And if we just only do the schools, then you don't have the residual impacts in other types of parts of community development.
You said that mayors were worried that there's not a comprehensive or a cohesive urban agenda. If you were writing that agenda, obviously one of the things that would be on it is better data collection and better use of data. What else would be on that cohesive urban agenda?
Well, it's interesting, Carol. If you look at the way most cities are organized, they're organized along the revenue streams that the federal government used to produce. So you have your typical community development department, you have economic development, you have transportation. They're not organized along functionality. And I think that one of the things that there's a growing awareness amongst the mayors is that we need to look at the functional roles of government and reorganize government along functionality. And what I mean by that is that if we're saying that we need a new transportation allocation for mass transportation, or are we saying that we need another way to move people from the suburbs into the cities, or are we saying that we need to help people move around the cities more so that they're able to live in a certain community and work in another community, or they can drop their kids off on the way to school, on the way to work at yet a third community? So it's using transportation as a way of reorganizing the paths that people follow every day, as opposed to a much more narrow understanding of people from the suburbs need to get downtown to work.
So you perform something called a drill down. Tell me about that, what it reveals, and how that information gets used in cities.
Sure. The drill down at the very heart of it is a data mining exercise to capture the missed population and missed income at a given community. And we've worked in 12 cities to date. And when I say 12, we've only worked in three entire cities. So it's parts of 12 cities for the most part. And we found 850,000 people missed by the census or census estimates. And we've found an additional $35 billion of missed economic income in those communities. If these numbers continue tracking at the rate they're tracking, we will expect to have found close to 3.5 million people missed by the U.S. Census in 30 cities or parts of 30 cities by next year. And that's important for two reasons. One, the information barrier makes it very difficult for the grocer to decide where to put a new grocery store, or the financial service to understand where to put a new bank branch. But maybe even more importantly, it affects underwriting decisions and how the cost points for title insurance or mortgage insurance or various underwriting needs are how those cost points are constructed. So it's a barrier for private investment, but on the public side as well. The U.S. Conference of Mayors estimates that for every person not counted in the census, the city loses $2,200 a year. So that 3 million number would also represent an additional $4 billion that's not going to these same communities today that needs that money very desperately, whether it's community development block grant money or whatnot. So we gathered this money and then tried to make the case both to the public sector and the private sector that they need to challenge their census. They need to work on their formulas with the federal government. But on the private sector, how do we work with Citibank to help them find new bank branches in LMI neighborhoods? Or how do we work with a Kroger's or a national retailer to find a different lens to help them make a better decision about going into a city? And if you look at Columbia Heights here in Washington, D.C., you know, that was a very good example of where information and the Mayor Williams led the effort to really bring another $150 million of investment to a community that had been very badly divested from since the riots had occurred, you know, a couple of decades ago.
There's a lot of excitement in the design world about serving, redesigning products, redesigning packaging to serve developing nations. Do you sense the same sort of excitement on the part of American bankers, American retailers, trying to get it at low-income markets where there may be more sales potential, more deposit potential, credit potential than they originally thought?
Absolutely. And I'll give you a couple examples. One, First American and the Neighborhood Housing Services of America and Citibank last week just announced a new mortgage product that's based on – not only is it based on a well-priced 30-year fixed mortgage, but this is a product for LMI families that have poor or no credit. So the second part of this product was that they're using alternative credit to value the applicant. So they're using church tithing, or they're using utility payments, or things that don't necessarily show up on your FICO score unless for some reason you're not paying. So the fact that they're looking at this is really an exciting opportunity to move 2,000 in the case of the district alone to new homeowners into homes at a well-priced, well-produced mortgage instrument. That's a great example of where innovation really is being introduced, because it's not just a matter, and this is where I think the community development, the community bankers' perspective. You can put five people mortgages in a neighborhood, but we've got to do something to make sure that the value of that community is protected, that there's small businesses going down the street that you can buy your milk locally. And I think that efforts like that, like Bank of America's Block by Block initiative to bring all its different lines of business together in very small locales, is a really innovative way of looking at community development where the private sector is taking the lead. And what they expect from the public sector in this situation is to create an environment where they can operate, so that it's transparent, it's effective, in some cases it's efficient. But if the public sector can create the investment environment, the investment climate that allows the private sector to come in and do what they do best, then you really have a really robust new way of looking at community development. And then you just have to make sure that it's connected to the communities themselves. And again, that's the role of information.
You have, speaking of information, your board is filled with representatives of major financial institutions. Surely you've talked with your board members about how the mortgage crisis occurred. I mean, mm-hmm. How did we get here? Couldn't they look ahead and see that these adjustable rate mortgages were being made to people who were not going to be able to pay them when those rates went up? I mean, how did we get here?
Well, I've got 15 board members and 30 opinions. I think that we got way ahead of ourselves, and there's certainly bad actors that were responsible for some of this mess, and the federal government has a role to play as well. But we got ahead of ourselves. As I was saying, affordable housing, the infrastructure, so much of it is done, and it was. It's hard to look forward. We don't want to look forward and say, there'll be a time when interest rates go up. There'll be a decline time when home sales go down. And because we don't want to say that, we continue to securitize bad decisions, and we get to pass that into different portfolios and tranche it. And I think that was the problem, is that the industry took on a momentum of its own. So it wasn't necessarily a problem with one actor or one good actor or one bad actor or how we graded the paper. It was just there was a momentum to this, because at the end of the day, we all believe that home ownership is so critical, and we were doing everything we could to try to move as many folks into homes that could possibly go into them, and the result was we made a lot of bad decisions.
You work, again, in very tough neighborhoods. How do you get momentum started in one of those neighborhoods? You collect the data. Now you know you've got more people than you thought. You know there's more money than you thought. But then what happens? How do you get that first step going, John?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's the problem with what we do is, while we like to say, look, we are science-oriented and we extend the science to the communities, at the end of the day, this is all about finding the right partners. – And going back to this example in Washington, D.C., if it weren't Bob Moore, who's the head of the Columbia Heights Community Development Corporation, and Michael Stevens, who at the time was the head of the Washington, D.C. Economic Partnership, it was those two champions. If Bob were to leave and his replacement success were to come in tomorrow, it may not have a champion. But it's the information only gives people the opportunity to take a second look. It doesn't create the program. It doesn't connect the program to the street. It doesn't connect the information to the investor. And so it really took a team of people who were all personally committed both to having better information, but more importantly, having a vision for what Columbia Heights could look like if it just had adequate capital to invest in it. And so led by Mayor Williams and his team and the partnership and Bob Moore, they went out over and over and over again with the information saying, look, you got to take a second look. Washington's a good place to be. And that's the case if you look at Gulfgate Mall in Houston, if you look at some of the downtown developments going on in downtown Detroit, if you look at some of the stuff that's going on and over the Rhine and uptown in Cincinnati, that it really does start with information, local champions, but who have the opportunity and the position to make decisions in a community, and a vision for the community. When those three things come together, then community development happens. If any of those things fall apart, the information by itself doesn't lead to development. A local champion without information doesn't necessarily lead to development. It takes all those three roles coming together to begin the momentum that leads us down to neighborhood change.
And that makes sense. But I want to ask you about physical markers that may exist. Do you think there are markers? Perhaps they're not physical. Maybe they're social. Maybe they're cultural. Is there something that you think sends a powerful signal to that gives buyers or bankers or locals the confidence to invest?
I think now that with what HMDA is telling us and what access to IRS and postal codes, and I think those kinds of sets, what do new building permits tell us? Or what do does First American have a tool that helps us model what the projected land values of a small community or an investment in that small community? So those tools are now being developed and coming thanks to SAS, thanks to ESRI, thanks to the financial services, so that we have a generation of development tools that mayors and communities have access to. But it's the same tools that the private sector has been using for a generation in the suburbs, but we're now tailoring them to the specific needs of inner city communities.
John, thanks so much for what you do, and thanks for being with us on Smart City.
Carol, I appreciate it.
John Talmadge is President and Chief Executive of Social Compact. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. As you're listening to our show today, take a look at the strangers around you. City View's commentator Walker Smith says you may be more connected to them than you realize.
As a sophomore in college, I shared a dorm room with Henry, a guy I knew from high school in North Carolina. His girlfriend at the time was from Atlanta. She and I were talking one day about where we'd grown up, and she mentioned having lived for a while in Spartanburg, South Carolina. "Really?" I said with some surprise. "I went to elementary school there." "What a coincidence," she replied with equal surprise. I asked what street she had lived on, thinking I might know it. After all, Spartanburg is not that big. Clifton Avenue was her answer. My family lived on three streets in Spartanburg before we moved for a job my dad took in North Carolina. Originally, we lived on Kent Place. Then my parents built a house on Shoreham Road. In between, though, after the house on Kent Place had sold and before our house on Shoreham Road was completed, we rented a house on Clifton Avenue. So, understandably, my casual conversation with Henry's girlfriend suddenly got more specific. "Looking out from the front porch of our house," I said, "to the right there was an English family that lived in the house on the corner." Silence was her immediate response to my statement. And then she said, "As you looked out from the front porch of our house," virtually echoing my words, there was an English family living in the corner house to the right. It turns out that she and I had lived in the same house. As near as we could determine, her family had moved in shortly after my family had moved out. And not only had we lived in the same house, in comparing notes, she and I realized that we had had the same bedroom, which enabled me to tease Henry for years that I was the first person to share a bedroom with his girlfriend. We all have our own small world stories, because the world, as big as it is ultimately a small place. At every turn, our connections to others amaze us with their intimacy and profusion. But it's really not that remarkable. We come from common stock, something that all theories of human origins agree on, whether it's evolution or the literal word of the Bible. Human history is a long tale of non-stop intermingling through migration, conquest, trade, exploration, and communication. No matter what we tell ourselves or what we do to enforce rigid boundaries, the Thomas Jeffersons and Strom Thurmonds will put our prejudices to shame, reminding us yet again that the humanity we share in common is always stronger than any chauvinism trying to keep us apart. That house on Clifton Avenue connects me with a lot of people, not just Henry's college girlfriend. For everyone who lived there, that house means a common experience of a neighborhood, a community, and a circle of long-lost friends that, in our own separate ways, have played a part, large and small, in shaping our lives, in making our worlds a little smaller by tying us together. Shared roots like these make our lives a lot bigger. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.